In the valley of the shadow, I got a feeling it's season that'll make me grow. I'm still breathing, I got praise in my lungs, in the choir in my soul, can't steal my joy.
Good morning, church. I am Diana Shiflett. I'm the Arlington campus pastor, if you haven't met me yet, but I have the honor and privilege of coming out here about once a month and bringing the sermon that I preached over there. I practice over there, so you get like, yeah, right? Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. It's any order. You never know. It's always a surprise, but I have practice, so hopefully it'll be better than the last three that I've done. So the title of this sermon is called, What is in Your Hand? Isn't that so profound? What is in your hand? You're like, I have nothing in my hand. Nothing up my sleeve, right? Kaz named the sermon, and I don't always have a title for my sermon, but when he said it, I was like, ooh, that's good. That'll preach. So I was like, I'm using it. Well, I want to tell you what was in my hand when I was in high school. In high school, some of you know this part of my story and some of you don't. I was a part of a vocational program where you learned how to teach preschool. And I loved this because I was terrible at school. And the way it worked was you could get on a bus for half of your school day and go to a whole nother school, and I got to hang out with preschoolers. It was so fun. I loved it. And so that was junior and senior year. And one of the assignments one day was to make a puppet. And I was like, ooh, this is going to be so fun. I got my first burn from a glue gun, so I did learn some things while I was making that. But let me just tell you about my puppet. She was so cute. So I was like, I got to make a puppet. It's got to be really good. So I went to the garage, and I found a plastic little pot, you know, like that you would pot a plant in. And then I went up to my sock drawer because, I mean, if you're going to make a puppet, you need a sock, right? And I found a nice, long, green, knee-high sock, and I made a cute little Daisy puppet. She had, like, a little... I would show you a picture of her, but somebody stole her. Well, that's how I know she was really good. I mean, she must have been really cute, right? But this is actually something that I was excited about because back when I was 11 years old, I had a camp counselor and she was a ventriloquist. Oh, she was so fun and so good. Her name was Jewel. She's still alive. I reached out to her on Facebook. And she had this, one of those wooden, she didn't let us call it a dummy, a wooden doll, and her name was Rachel, and Jewel was so kind to a very annoying 11-year-old girl. For that whole week, I was overly needy and overly like, I need your attention, right? And she gave me full attention, and so did Rachel. I felt so honored and loved that week I was at camp, and it was really fun. I was so enamored by this woman that by the time it was time to write that career report in eighth grade, I wrote it on ventriloquism. Isn't that awesome? If I had been that eighth grade teacher, I'd have been like, this might be the best one ever. I might have stolen it as well. But what I loved about it is she took it very seriously, and she actually gave me a decent grade. I don't get decent grades. And I was like, wow, she must think ventriloquism is pretty amazing. So I just loved that teacher took that career report seriously, because it actually was a little bit of what launched me into ministry, because that little puppet that I made actually was what launched me into going to college. And you're like, a puppet? Yes. So I was not a good student for 11 years and struggled tremendously in school. And when I got to make a puppet, I was like, it's time for me to shine, right? And so I did, and we also had to teach with said puppet. And thankfully, whoever stole her, I think her name was Daisy, whoever stole her waited until I actually got to teach with her. So I actually got the best grade. And I was like, finally, I am making a difference, right? These little preschoolers loved it. I loved making it. I loved teaching with my little puppet. But what it did is it actually got me noticed for the first time by a teacher ever. And she, for my grades, and she good grades. And she said, I'm nominating you to be student of the month. I was like, whoa, student of the month? I remember we got like this beer stein for being student of the month. I don't know what that was about. We were in high school, but anyway, I thought that was awesome. And actually what it also launched me into is like this group of people that then were looked at to whether or not you'd be student of the year. And I actually became student of the year for that little puppet situation. And I got $1,000 to go to college. Yeah. It's actually not that much money when you go to college, but especially in Illinois, by the way. here in Tennessee, that might sound like a lot. But here's the thing. I was not going to go to college because I wasn't a good student. And here was this little puppet that came into my life and said, you can be a good student. You just need a puppet. You just need a little side gig, right? And I went away to college, and as they say, the rest is history, right? I didn't stay in preschool, if you haven't noticed. One of the things that was also really cool about this woman, Jewel, who came into my life when I was 11, she not only paid attention to me for that week of camp, she actually took me to something called Christian Magicians Conference. What? Did you even know there was one of the? It is one of the most fun conferences I've ever been to. There was always someone showing you a magic trick, always someone like using somebody else to be their puppet. It was amazing. It was such a fun week. And while I was there, I had saved my babysitting money, and I was like, I'm going to buy my first ventriloquist doll. Like, I'm gonna get one. And so I bought Susie then, and she was, you know, she looked more like a Muppet, kind of like the ones we saw here, but she had legs. She wasn't a puppet. She was a, you know, full, she had legs, and I used to make her legs swing, and I was, you know, I wasn't good at all. But I had spent that whole week, and I learned how to do ventriloquism, and it was so fun. And so, you know, you fast forward through college, and I still have this puppet, and I'm asked by that camp if I would be the speaker at the camp I grew up at. Whoa, right? I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And then they told me you have to teach the 8-year-olds all the way through 16. Well, I was a youth pastor, so I knew like the 11 to 18 age group. I did not know how to do this 10, 11, you know, that and younger 8-year-olds. I had no idea. And I kind of reacted like Moses did. A couple weeks ago, Kaz started talking about Moses, and Moses kind of pushed back a couple of times along the way, and he's like, I can't do that. And God was talking to him, and he's like, well, what do you have in your hand, right? And Moses is like, well, I had in my hand little Susie. And so I felt like God was like, just use Susie. And so Susie and I went on the road, and we killed it. We really killed it. It was amazing. Actually, we videoed it, and I just hope that VHS tape does not exist anywhere anymore. But Jewel, we've been in this adventure series, and if you're in an adventure group, you've been talking about your values and what matters for eternity. And I was thinking about Jewel and how she taught me some interesting things about my values, because that was one of the things, like, who in your life taught you your faith values? And one of the things that she taught me was to value people, even if it's like someone that's annoying, right? Because I knew, like even in the moment that I was bugging her, I knew it. But I had this deep need to be loved and cared for. But the other thing she taught me is if it matters for eternity, even if it's weird, go ahead and do it, right? And she walked around with this doll, and she was a missionary for Jesus. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever, that she would be willing to do this. Now, Kaz talked about Moses' story a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about how he stepped out of his comfort zone and he had to invest deeply. And what I like about Moses' story is that there's so much going on in Moses' story. You can't just talk about it once. And so I wanted to talk about it a little bit again. And so I'm going to start in Exodus 3:11, where this is how Moses reacts. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I?" What I really think Moses helps us with is we all feel that way. Who am I? Who am I to do the big thing that God's asking me to do? I had that feeling this week. I was going into a building team meeting with architects and engineers and people way smarter than me, and I thought to myself, what am I doing in this room? And he's like, get to work, right? I need you. And this is what God says to us when we say that to him. And God said, I will be with you. And God said, I will be with you. I will be with you. We don't have to worry because God says, I will be with you. And you would think that this would be enough for us. But of course, we always have the next thing, just like Moses. One more excuse, right? Like why we can't do it. In chapter 4, we're going to jump all the way to chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answered, "What if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, 'The Lord did not appear to you'?'" I mean, have you ever, like, I thought about that even as going into that, and like, are you sure that the Lord gave you this vision? I was like, no, he gave it to Kaz, and I'm just running it out, right? right? No, he gave it to us as a community, and God gave it to us, and we're going to run it out. We all have felt that before. Like, who are you? And did God really say that to you? And all of us are like, well, I'm going to need some proof, God, right? And so we turn to God, and then the Lord said to him, "What's in your hand?" And so a little bit about Moses at this point. I don't know, you know, if you're catching up to the story, but he has run away from Egypt, right? And he is hiding at this point. He's trying to not be found at this point. So he is as ordinary as he could be. That was what he was trying to do. He was trying to be a shepherd at this point. He was probably doing a great job. I'm sure he was a great shepherd. But what was in his hand was a staff. It was his everyday thing he had in his hand every single day. It wasn't odd that he had it in his hand. And so when I think about that puppet that I had, when God said, "Hey, I want you to speak to 8 to 10-year-olds for about 7 to 10 hours for a whole week," I was like, what in the world? How am I going to be able to do this? And he asks, "What's in your hand?" And I was like, well, you're going to have to prove it too, right? and that's really where Moses is at this point. And then as he moves forward and he's thinking about this, what's in my hand, he's like, well, this is what's in my hand. And for us, when we think about what is in our hand, we often have an excuse when we don't feel like using it, right? We're like, I got this, but I don't feel like using it. Moses was trying to hide, like us. We try to hide when maybe we're just starting to go to church. We're trying to hide. We like pick a bigger church and we hide when we're there. Or maybe we're grieving and we're hurt and we just are trying to hide. Or maybe there's a new diagnosis and we just want to be invisible and hide. Or maybe your marriage is falling apart and you just want to hide. Or maybe life at work is feeling impossible at this point and you feel like you just want to hide. And really, if we're honest, like anytime something gets hard in our life, we want to hide. It's one of our first responses is to hide. But the good news is that God is a pursuer. And he doesn't let us hide. He pursues us. He loves us. He loves us well. He's not a mean pursuer. He pursues us because he loves us and wants us to be a part of what he is doing. And when we doubt that something could be real, he keeps pursuing and equipping. And so if we go on in Exodus 4, we see that God starts to equip Moses because he's like, I don't know, I'm going to need some proof. I'm going to need to prove to other people. But I feel like what he was really saying is, I don't believe in myself. You're going to have to help me believe in myself. And God says this, the Lord said, throw it onto the ground. And Moses threw it onto the ground and it became a snake and he ran from it. I was talking to my security guys at the other campus when I did this. He's like, don't throw it on the ground. I'm really afraid of snakes. So I won't throw it on the ground, just to be sure. But what Moses does here is he wanted to run from it. Think about this in your life. Think about this in your life. When God has asked you to do something and it's in your hand and you give it over to him and then it's like powerful and you're like, yipes, and you jump back and you think, I don't know if I can be a part of this. Like, I'm watching God's power. Like, as I sat in that building team meeting and they were moving the building around onto the Arlington campus and it landed where it was supposed to be, I was like, whoo, that's scary. Because the church is going to grow. It's God's power. And you want to run in those moments. And what does God do? What does God say? Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is so that you may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. I'm going to equip you. I am giving you what you need. When you need to, you can throw this down and it'll become a snake and they will believe you. And Cass talked about the other party tricks that Moses got to do. He did the leprosy trick with his hand and the turning the water into blood. But what do we have in our hands that God can use, that God wants us to use? We don't have to worry about if we can do it, because he can do it. He is calling each of us. In your adventure groups right now, you've been talking about what adventure is God calling you to individually? What is he calling to you as your little family unit? What is he calling you to as a church? We're talking about all of these things, and our emotions get all tangled up in it, right? I've heard a lot of people like, I don't know if we can do it. I'm like, I know we can't, but I know God can, right? I know that we can't, but God can. And if it's a God vision, then it will happen. The adventure we are on is something that he is doing, and we are entering into that with him. Some of you might already have a job that would explain what you have in your hands, right? Like, your job might be something that you could offer to God and do. Some of you have passions and hobbies that also might be something that you could offer to God. At my last church, there was this guy named Russ. And he owned the mechanic shop just like less than a mile from the church. And his dad had given it to him when his dad died younger than Russ expected. And so Russ had this building, and he had the skills because his dad had taught him how to be a mechanic. And Russ created this thing called the Cars Ministry. And every Tuesday night, he invited anybody that wanted to come to learn how to fix cars. And like, if you were a parent, you could bring your younger child. Like, I feel like there were 8-year-olds in there sometimes. And he was they'd be under the car and they'd be doing it. And one day I came by to visit in my white pants and he's like, oh, Diana, you do not understand this. And I was like, I'm just seeing how it goes. And so every Tuesday night, they would do that ministry. But they also did this really cool ministry to the single moms. They did a single mom oil change twice a year. And that's when I got to shine. He was like, you're going to be the translator. And I was like, okay. And so I'd wear my white pants because I didn't want to really get into the, garage. But so I would come stand under the car and Russ would be like, okay, so here's what's broken. And this is the manifold. And then and he'd say all these words that I didn't know. And he'd be like, so go tell her. I was like, okay. your car is broken. And that's all they needed to know. But here's the cool part. If you can drop off your car on Tuesday night at 5 p.m., there's a group of people that would love to fix your car for the cost of the part. Don't you wish you had one of those? Yeah, amen, right? Right? And so that would happen. But another really cool part of that is some people who didn't need to trade their car in because they had so much money, they could just donate their car when they were done with it. They would donate it to Cars Ministry. Cars Ministry would give it a once-over. They'd figure it out. They'd fix anything that was broken. And then sometimes when I had to do the translation to the single mom, I'd be like, I have really bad news. Russ does not think that your car is roadworthy and it's too dangerous to drive, and we cannot fix it. But here's the good news. Russ just fixed a car last week with the Cars Ministry, and it cost $600 for the parts. If you have $600, we can give you that car. I would have weeping women in my arms, and I felt like God was showing up. They felt loved and cared for when they felt abandoned. It was so cool to watch the eternal perspective that was happening on that location. And all he was doing was handing over what he already had. He didn't have to do it during business hours, so he wasn't losing business. And it was not his to begin with, right? His dad gave it to him, and he was just giving it back to be used. That is happening around both campuses all the time right now. There are people here, right here in this building, musicians who spent their younger days learning how to do instruments that are now using their gifts to minister to us, to lead us in worship. There's a security team that keeps us protected. A lot of them, that is their day job, and they're doing it for us for free on Sunday morning. There are teachers. There is a medical team. There are daycare workers. There are parents using their parenting skills. There are people with the gift of hospitality. There's a maintenance team, a building team, and artists. I could go on and on and on. There are 80 people over at the Arlington campus sharing their gifts, and there are over 200 people here at this campus. That's amazing. And that's how it works. We take what is in our hands and hand it over to God, and he furthers his kingdom in us and through us. Now, as a kid, I had a puppet, and God used it to further his kingdom. The really good news is I had a nephew a few years back who totally got into ventriloquism, and I was like, oh, yeah. Here's Susie. And so Susie now lives with Hudson, and Hudson's doing the deep spiritual work of ventriloquism at this point. And I don't know what God's going to do with that, but now he's older now, and so he's doing like little those speech teams and things like that. And so who knows what God's going to do in and through him. But here's the really good news. You will never see me up here with a puppet doing ventriloquism. I'm actually terrible at it. I want to rewind a second to who Moses was at the beginning of his life. He was born as a Hebrew, which meant he was chosen. He was one of God's people from the very beginning. And he also had the honor and the privilege of being raised royalty. And some of you in this room might say, I was not born into a family who loved God, and I certainly did not grow up as a royal. I have good news. There's a story in the New Testament about a little boy. It takes place in the book of John, is where I'm actually going to read it from today, but it actually is talked about in all four Gospels, which is very important for us to know. That means it is important. All four of the authors felt it was important to know this story. And so today, as we listen to it, know that there were four gospel writers that thought we should hear this. But I'm going to read it from the book of John, and we're going to be in chapter 6, and I'm going to start at verse 5. When Jesus looked up, he saw a great crowd coming toward him. He said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered, "It would take more than a half year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." I love this because Philip's like, sir, we do not have enough. There is not a chance that even everyone would get a bite. Like, he's, you know, there's nothing like your boss coming to you and you're like, we can't. And I felt like Jesus was probably like, that's what I wanted you to acknowledge. You can't, but I can. Verse 8, another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with five small barley loaves and two small fish. But how far will they go among so many?" All right, so we got another disciple who's like, we have something, but I also am going to acknowledge we don't have enough. And the amazing part about this, the five barley loaves is significant. And this is where I get to the thinking about Moses versus this young boy. We don't even get this young boy's name. That's powerful to think about. But he also is poor because of the barley loaves. Barley loaves were what people ate if they couldn't afford other things. So we can know that this person didn't come from a lot of money. So now we got a little boy's lunch to feed one, and it's not a spectacular meal, shall we say. Andrew knew that they did not have enough to feed 5,000. And Jesus actually loved that. And Jesus didn't say, "Oh, okay, never mind then. I don't even want what you have." No, he's like, I'll take that and let's go. So verse 10, Jesus said, "Have the people sit down. There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed it to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the five barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. So not only did one little boy's lunch feed 5,000 plus, because the women and children were also fed, there were leftovers and enough for each disciple to take a basket home, right? You got 12 leftover baskets. Jesus was about equipping them for the work, because he didn't just be like, "I got this, guys, sit down." He said, "Tell the people to sit down." He was equipping the disciples, "Tell the people to sit down." And then he took what was given to him. And the next piece, we're going to pull from all the Gospels now. Mark 6:38 says, Jesus asks, "How many loaves do you have?" Okay, so Jesus is actually asking the people because he wants to include the people. And he was talking to the disciples, but the disciples like turned around and were like, "Does anybody have anything?" And this little boy's like, "I got my lunch," right? And so he engaged not just the disciples, but the disciples engaged the people in this. And then in Matthew and Luke, both of them say, "We only have five loaves and two fish." We only have. Have you ever felt yourself say that? "Well, I only have. It's not enough." When I think about the adventure campaign, I'm like, "Lord, I don't have enough." He's like, "I know." "I only have," and he's like, "I know. It's okay. I want to do this." God pursues us, and he wants what's in our hands. He's not asking us for more than what we are already holding, and he wants to equip us. Now, this is the thing that's in all four Gospels, and I love that it's in all four Gospels. It says, Jesus took the bread and the fish from the disciples, and he held it to heaven, and he gave thanks, and he gave thanks, and he then gave it back to the disciples to distribute. So what God is asking of us, he's asking the question, what's in your hand, right? And when we say we have 5 loaves and 2 fishes, I know it's not enough. He's like, great, I will take that and I'm going to hold it to heaven and I'm going to ask God to bless it. And then I am going to hand it back to you to do the kingdom work. He wants us to be a part of it. He is asking, what do you have in your hands? About 15 years ago, there was a group of 6 people left at the Arlington campus. It was not a part of Advent yet. And the 6 of them came to the Cordova campus and said, we have one 100-year-old building and 6 people. It's what's left in our hands. And they knew it was not enough. And God raised it to heaven with Dave Schieber. And he said, blessed it, thanked God for it, and he handed it back to his people. And those 6 disciples and the disciples of the Cordova campus at that point went to work. And when I arrived 2.5 years ago, there were about 40 people in that church. And we did it again. We raised it up and said, have your way, Lord. And today, there were 112 people at that campus. Mm-hmm. But we're about to do it again. Because there's a piece of land out there sitting in a growing community, and we're about to hold it up. God's about to hold it up and say, all right, bless it and multiply it. But he's going to give it back to us to do the work. He wants us to be a part of the work. When Moses had his staff, he kept carrying it. And it was the thing that he used to start each plague. He used that. He used it to tap the rock, to pour out water when they need it. He threw it into the ground to part the sea. God asks us what's in your hand. He equips us and he sends us and he wants us to be a part of his work. 3 years ago, when I got that campus pastor job description, I was like, I think I might have actually physically done this because, you know, I'm a kinesthetic learner. I was reading it, and I was probably on my screen, and I went like this because it felt like someone had just described me. It wasn't a job description. It felt like just who I was. And so 2.5 years ago, I just brought myself and what I had. And this church community with God lifted it up and said, God, have your way. And then you know what he did? He handed it right back and he said, get to work. Today, as we walk out these doors, you're going to get a giving guide, a pledge guide. And on there, I want you to think about what is in my hands, because it's not just about who we are and what we have, like the puppet. But it's also our financial means that God needs us, but only what we have. 5 loaves and 2 fish. What do you have in your hands? What is God asking you to give to him so he can hold it up and he can multiply it into 4 million, right? He's going to do that work. We get to just take it back and distribute it, like he's called us to. What is in your hand? What is God asking you to give over to him? And then when he hands it back, we better be ready, because he's about to do some good work. Let's pray. Oh God, we love that you hand it back. But you also ask us at the beginning to see what we have in our hands and to acknowledge it and to use it for your kingdom. And God, as we hold those things sometimes really tightly, I ask, God, that you would allow us to release it, to throw it to the ground so that we can see your mighty power. And God, when you hand it back to us to do your work, help us, show us, guide us. May we be the people who further your kingdom the way that you're calling us to. In your holy name we pray, Jesus. Amen.